It's a privilege to be here, to be back, and to have the opportunity to speak a little bit about this project that, as Nicholas said, exists in a number of different forms, one of which is on the balcony in the foyer. I'm Reinhold Martin. I direct the what's called the Temple Hoyne Buell Center for the Study of American Architecture at Columbia University. We're essentially a kind of academic research center, and we have taken up the question of housing in a number of different ways over the last 7 or 8 years. And so what you're seeing here and what you're going to hear from us today, just now, is a dimension, or reflects one aspect of this project. I'm not going to say too much right now in the beginning, because Jacob Moore, who is officially the program coordinator at the Buell Center, but is also co-curator of the exhibition with Susanna Schindler, and co-editor of all three of us, on the object that we're actually going to spend most of our time on, since you can have a look at the exhibition yourself, but this book called The Art of Inequality, which accompanies the project and points in a somewhat different direction than the exhibition itself. So I'll just let Jacob begin, and then we'll kind of go down the line that way. Okay.
Thanks, Reinhold. So, like he said, in the interest of time, and in the hope that you guys can go visit the exhibition just down the stairs yourselves and interpret it in relationship with everything else that here is shown. I'm just going to present the project's basic structure, which, as Nicholas indicated and Reinhold also indicated, is sort of multifaceted and has been shown in lots of different places and in a few different forms. Then I'll briefly introduce and read from the publication that Reinhold mentioned that clarifies many of the exhibition's themes and about which Reinhold and Suzanne will speak a little bit more. I should also say here at the beginning that the work we say is done by the Buell Center is done by many more people than just the three of us. It involves different teams of graduate students from the Architecture School and Columbia University at large, some of which are here today. And also, house housing certainly wouldn't have been possible without the very close collaboration with our designers, MTWTF, who are represented here by Glenn Cummings. So I should also say everything for the project is found on our website, househousing.com, which you'll see a few slides of in just a second. So the exhibition presented here just down the stairs, House Housing, An Untimely History of Architecture and Real Estate in 29 Episodes, is, as the title indicates, structured in reconfigurable modules. These non-chronologically arranged episodes, which mark indicative but certainly not comprehensive moments where policy, finance, and design intersect, map out the beginnings of what we understand as a history of architecture and real estate, represented with a set of multimedia artifacts that range from presidential radio addresses to architectural plans and sections, from marketing videos of various stripes to corporate annual reports. Beyond the exhibition in particular, the project at large is modular at a larger scale. House Housing has appeared in numerous locations as exhibitions, panel discussions, and publications, and relates to different institutional frames. So exhibition locations, as Nicholas indicated, to date include in Venice, as in conversation with the Venice Architecture Biennial in June 2014. very different spaces, as you can see, certainly compared to here. Currently, at the National Public Housing Museum, as a part of the inaugural Chicago Architecture Biennial, and it'll be up through, we're extending the run through December, which is exciting. Here, which I don't need to elaborate on. And next, in the spring, it'll appear at the Schindler House, the Mack Center Schindler House location on Kings Road in West Hollywood, California. So each of these locations has site-specific installations that shuffle the material you see downstairs, adding some episodes and taking away others, depending on site and context. So we're also developing, I should say, a pop-up version of the show that will first appear at UCSD with Teddy Cruz here in the audience, that will point towards some of the site-specific installations that we've worked on and allow for activation and programming in the sites where it shows up. So like Reinhold said, For today's presentation, we'd like to focus on another component of house housing, a recently launched publication entitled The Art of Inequality, Architecture, Housing, and Real Estate, a Provisional Report. This book's report format was inspired in part by one of the artifacts you'll find in the exhibition just down the stairs, the report of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, which was more colloquially known as the Kerner Report. That report was commissioned by U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1967 in response to the race riots that had recently been taking place across the United States. The questions President Johnson charged the commission with answering were, what happened, why did it happen, and what can be done? In the face of dramatically rising rates of inequality worldwide, we chose to think through the themes of our exhibition and our larger research project on architecture, housing, and real estate within this frame by asking a revised version of Johnson's questions in the present tense. What is happening? Why is it happening? And how is it happening? The contents of the book relate to this tripartite structure, and I'm now going to dive in and read a short passage from the first part, which I co-authored with Suzanne Schindler, before I pass it on to her, and she's going to read another few sections in it, and then we'll pass it to Reinhold, who will read from his a section he wrote, and also zoom back and I believe read a second from the introduction and talk about some of the larger themes. So in the first part of the book that I'm going to read from, we work to describe the many ways inequality is defined, narrated, and designed. This passage is from the second of those sections called Narrating Inequality, and Framing Data is the actual section. Appropriately then, it is widely accepted that inequality, especially when construed as a threat to the American dream, is a defining issue of our time, as the following quotations related to the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign indicate. This is Jeb Bush in 2015. Millions of our fellow citizens across the broad middle class feel as if the American dream is now out of their reach. Too many of the poor have lost hope that a path to a better life is within their grasp. While the last 8 years have been a pretty good ones for the top earners, they've been a lost decade for the rest of America. And this is Hillary Clinton in 2014, actually. Today, more people are getting by, but they're not getting ahead. At the same time, the top 25 hedge fund managers make more than all the kindergarten teachers in the country combined, and the top CEOs earn 300 times more than a typical American worker. It's time for everyday Americans to share in growth and prosperity. And then Marco Rubio, 2015. Income inequality is a symptom of a bigger problem, opportunity inequality. And then finally, Bernie Sanders, just a cross-section of all the candidates that really were bringing it up in their own ways. Bernie says, we live in one of the wealthiest countries on earth, yet children go hungry, veterans sleep out on the streets, and senior citizens cannot afford their prescription drugs. This is what a rigged economic system looks like. Taken at face value, the exhortations of scholars and talking points for would-be presidents evince a common understanding of inequality as a principally economic issue, whose explanations are best framed by considerations of a nebulously defined middle class. Though finer points are debated, a consensus emerges about the basic nature of the problem at hand, which in turn dictates the nature of any possible solutions. This rhetorical loop defines the current limits of the discourse on inequality. But the fact nevertheless remains, as demonstrated quite specifically by housing, that understandings and usages of, quote, inequality, end quote, as a call to action cannot be uniformly or exclusively filtered through an economic sieve. Doing so presupposes the economy as an isolated phenomenon that takes precedence over all else. And then just jumping very briefly ahead. In a period that has now been labeled the Great Acceleration in reference to human-generated climate change, this suffusion of the sociocultural and environmental context with economic thinking must be understood as constitutive of the changing and accelerating nature of inequality as such. Seeing income inequality as both an egregious and insufficient marker of contemporary conditions cannot be dismissed as self-contradicting. Gay rights, seemingly improving at a rate unforeseen by many, counts as its most influential champions the same multinational corporations that emerged out of and for the suburbanized, reurbanized, and deregulated middle-class economics-driven conditions that enforce segregation and persecution in the first place. This is the nature of many contemporary structural contradictions. In its seemingly pragmatic focus on middle-class economics, today's oft-repeated narrative ultimately makes our most pressing problem more, not less, difficult to understand. Inequality is complex, and complex stories are not easy to tell. Given its continued emphasis on home ownership, the story of the American dream shows how design, traditionally brought in as a solution to problems, helps elucidate them as well. Unfortunately, in this elucidation, the agents of design themselves are often implicated. So I'll pass it to Suzanne for another short reading.
Thank you, Jacob. I will read four short samples of the report, two from part one, so that first part that Jacob has been reading from, which is on the concepts of inequality, and two from part three, which deals with its tools. So first, one of many reflections in this book as to how architecture, specifically architecture, interacts with the creation of inequality through housing. This one is about the design guidelines, zoning ordinances, and building codes of housing. The legal language of regulations and standards regarding what a dwelling unit is and how it is to be used pertains to us all, irrespective of income, cultural background, or lifestyle. At one level, these standards have thus led to far greater equality in terms of homogeneity in how the rich, poor, and all those in between live. A legal bedroom in the United States is required to meet certain criteria, irrespective of whether its construction was financed through tax credits or through an overseas shell company's cash. It may not be narrower than about 3 meters or less than 11 square meters, must have access to natural light and air, and contain a closet 60 centimeters deep and at least 150 centimeters wide. At the same time, standards and regulations have become the instrument of choice to maintain segregation by race or income. By stipulating minimum lot sizes, let's say 1 acre, which is about 0.4 hectares, and the maximum number of dwelling units per unit, per lot size, let's say one dwelling unit, a town can easily write out entire populations through its zoning ordinances without explicitly saying so. By virtue of the size of the parcel of land and the type of building that is allowable on it, a zoning code can only lead to the construction of generous single-family homes, which are unaffordable to anyone below a certain income. Okay, my second short piece is a reflection on the power of architecture to make otherwise often intangible conditions, such as inequality, quite tangible. So while architecture doesn't actually produce inequality as architecture, it can be extremely effective at both hiding it or exposing it, as became manifest in the poor doors debate in New York that began last year. In the summer of 2014, a scandal erupted around New York City's mixed-income housing development policy at One Riverside Park, a luxury condominium tower on New York's Upper West Side. In exchange for a 25-year property tax abatement, which means that for 25 years the development has to pay no property taxes, as well as a density bonus, which means they were allowed to build more, the project was required to include 20% affordable apartments. It did so not within a single building, as is generally required, but in an adjacent one named 50 Riverside Boulevard. The 291 condominium residences of One Riverside Park have sunset views across the Hudson River, and the units include up to 7-bedroom duplex apartments with swimming pools located on private terraces. The 55 income and price-restricted rental apartments count no more than 2 bedrooms are accessed from around the corner and have more basic amenities. The creation of a so-called poor door was first reported by a neighborhood blog in late 2013, and the newly coined term helped spur the story's international coverage. The difference between the amenities on the one side and those on the other are so extreme that the public discomfort was immediate. It was a very real and graspable architectural element of 2 separate entrances, not just personnel and staff in the back and residents and guests in the front, but the separation of residents of the same publicly subsidized deal that revealed the contradictions of a society that continues to assert that its members are created equal. What originated in a policy of invisibility, hiding both the cost of this luxury development to the public sector and the stigma of low-income housing by integrating it with the market-rate housing, imploded when these realities suddenly became visible in the form of 2 doors. In June of 2015, the zoning policy that allowed for the poor doors was rescinded. Okay, I'm jumping now to part three, which includes 5 pieces on the tools of inequality, ranging from renderings, textbooks, terminology, contracts, and schools. I will read from the introduction to the textbook section, written by Eric Carver, who I think is here today, who synthesized 5 book reports, who our team of researchers wrote book reports, who are sort of the general, the most read in real estate programs in the United States today. Textbooks are active, qualitative interfaces between a discipline and a profession. Textbooks perform disciplinarity. Their very existence lays claim to an exclusive terrain of knowledge. The professional textbook then erects upon this ground an edifice of institutional codes. The textbook is both a catalog of norms and a map of the system. The resulting artifact works to both socialize inductees and legitimize real estate as a field. Thus, we can understand its fundamental assumptions by following repetitions, anomalies, and omissions in the texts. Now I'm going to jump to contracts, a historic overview of the emergence of the legal constructs around land, which was written by Manuel Schwarzberg Carrió. Real estate historically mediates agreements and disputes over land, a form of power struggle that has become codified through the law. The central object of contention, is not land per se, but the very ontology of land, its status as something that can be variously possessed by an individual, traded, speculated upon, or held together by different political arrangements. Real estate thus has to be framed alongside legal philosophical discourses of the individual's right to private property, and, more fundamentally, the modern conception of individuality as a naturalized condition. Property, personhood, and market economics together form the historical conceptual milieu of which the field of real estate emerges. Contracts are agreements between individuals and other entities, and are thereby the vehicles by which the law's proper subjects, including entrepreneurs, tenants, corporations, and debtors, are recognized and produced. Reinhold.
Okay. All right, well, thanks. So you've just heard a few excerpts from, in a sense, the details of this report, and we're offering them to you in hopes that they will be sufficiently intriguing that you will actually be inclined to read the book. But just in case, I thought I'd say some more general things about the overall sort of project of the book, and by extension of the exhibition vis-a-vis this its title, really, The Art of Inequality. And so I'm going to read a couple of things, first from the introduction and then from the text that I contributed to this. So we begin the whole thing by asking, what is inequality? How does it work? In other words, not in some ontological sense that there is a being called inequality, but rather that this is a function. Inequality is a function, is a thing that does work. This report sketches a partial answer to these questions in architectural terms, specifically related to housing. By inequality, we mean not only the measurable socioeconomic gap that separates the very wealthy from the very poor. You heard our presidential candidates speaking about that in Jacob's quotations. But also a seemingly endless chain of inequities around which both individuals and social groups hold conflicting interests. And this notion of conflicting interests is extremely important. I think it's also thematized throughout the show in a variety of ways. The whole exhibition, the whole Wohnungsfrage. In fact, one could say that this is the Wohnungsfrage. The housing question as such is a question of conflicting interests. This report only addresses a small subset of these, mostly centered on economic disparities, but with a close eye on how they link with others, structural racism, gender discrimination, and other exclusions or expulsions that are internal, in other words, built in to the American housing system. And we're concentrating on the United States here, but really implying the connections, the very specific ways in which the socioeconomic inequities and inequalities that predominate in American cities, suburbs, and towns fundamentally relate to others elsewhere. So you can, you know, and we could talk about that too, about the relation of this system to others. As the book's subheading suggests, this is by no means a definitive document. We call it a provisional report, and it is a kind of, let's say, reference to the Kerner report that Jacob referred to. And it's compiled, though, in this case, not by a government agency, by an academic research center, on behalf of who? On behalf of students, our colleagues, all of you, anybody really, both within these set of fields that are gathered around this question and beyond, who are interested in asking and understanding concretely certain key facts that shape social and economic life. Now, among these facts, which we've outlined, are the numbers that are captured quite famously in the slogans referring to the 1%, the ruling elites, or the 99%, like everyone else, that reveal the starkest of disparities. But at the same time, these numbers conceal others that run up, down, and sideways across the socioeconomic spectrum. In other words, this is why this is not just a set of charts that explains why, you know, the sort of socioeconomic structure. Housing, understood as the material, social, institutional, and economic process that determines where members of a society sleep at night. In other words, very literally, that's what housing is. It's where you sleep. And also where they live and love, and perhaps where they die. Housing cuts an important cross-section through the dominant patterns. But like other instances of inequality, housing is not just an indicator of deeper trends. It consists of techniques that contribute to and perpetuate the very conflicts that might seem only to reflect, including architectural techniques. In other words, to misuse a well-known phrase, housing is a verb. It does things as well as represents them. This is what allows us to speak of something like a housing system, a dynamic set of relations, a portion of which this report sketches via the logic and the, as it were, laws of real estate development, including those that are codified in textbooks that Suzanne referenced, and then the codes and the standards and all the rest of it. So we therefore aim to show some of the ways in which real estate development effectively writes the laws that govern the American housing system, and perhaps by extension, the global housing system. The report's title, The Art of Inequality, emphasizes that far from being objectively given, these laws are pieces of artifice that amount to a way of governing, as in the expression, the art of governing. Insurmountable housing disparities are not a historical accident. So the issues that we're addressing are not an historical accident. Nor are they merely the unintended side effect of well-meaning policies and practices. They are designed. Inequality is designed, built into the system by which housing is produced and maintained in the first place. Architecture matters here precisely for this reason. For it, too, does not come after economic forces, those mysterious representatives of, like, this fictional thing called the economy, have done their work. Architecture doesn't come after that. Architecture actively participates at every step simply because there is no housing without architecture, however humbly defined or constrained its authors, architects, designers, policymakers, developers, bankers, residents, etc., however confined everyone may feel. And yes, it does seem that today everyone is talking about inequality, but perhaps that's because inequality is everywhere, and political standoffs between incentivized luxury development and rent regulation run parallel with a litany of racial violence that in turn reflects the role of both race and space in determining economic outcomes. Newspapers lament gentrification while featuring lush advertisements for improbable dwellings populated by two-parent, three-child families who seem only ever to be waiting for the guests to arrive. Housing is analyzed daily for its cause. It's not like nobody's talking about it. It's actually constantly being discussed in the public sphere. It's analyzed daily for its role in construction starts, mortgage interest rates, and home values growth or decline, with its artfulness largely relegated to sidebar commentaries in lifestyle magazines. The housing system is all of this and more. Understood most blatantly as the form given to real estate, we say here it is what makes real estate real, but also as an arrangement of material things that makes real estate possible, architecture is what makes real estate real, thus becomes both evidence and instrument of growing socioeconomic divides. Okay, and so that's an excerpt from the introduction, and I'll just say read a couple of things, maybe one or two things, about how this might work. So there's a section, that's been scrolling here that is the one that I was responsible for writing. We divided and divided this up, and it's called Real Estate Agency, and I'm just going to read a couple of pages from this. This echoes in more specific terms, more classically architectural terms, the general points that I was just making. So, simply put, real estate governs. You know, so it's not just that, again, like real estate is like this magical thing out there. It's a thing that does things. It's a process that does things. And what does it do? It governs. This is different from saying that it, capital, real estate, etc., determines. But what is it to govern? It may seem self-evident that to govern one needs a governor, an agent, or a set of agents, an institution, or a set of institutions. Real estate or real estate development may therefore seem an unlikely candidate for such a role. For though real estate is filled with agents, they typically figure only as brokers, as go-betweens, intermediaries, or at the other end of the circuit, as developers, oracles, who discern and develop potential, kind of magicians, right? And advisors or assistants who merely fulfill existing needs. But governing is an art. It derives from techniques, not agents. Inequality is one such technique. It's a technique. It is designed, built into the system, as I said before, to say what we already know as plainly as possible. Inequality in housing is an intentional consequence of the real estate system rather than a historical accident. Were there no inequality in income or wealth, and most housing in the current system is a form of wealth or capital, this is architecture as capital, not architecture and capital, architecture literally as capital, there would be no opportunity for profit or no incentive to speculate if this wasn't the case, and the system would collapse. From this perspective, the more inequality, the better, up to the point when it is no longer possible to extract additional profit from lower income groups lest they revolt, and higher income groups must be content to extract profit from one another. And here, one more quote that's rather been rather influential, but I think with some ambiguity. Even an economist like Joseph Stiglitz, who has done so much to call attention to increasingly intolerable levels of inequality worldwide, admits that it is nevertheless structural to the present system. This is Stiglitz. Quote, I, and as far as I know, most progressives, do not argue for full equality. So don't presume, you know, parenthetically, that when we take on inequality that we are somehow implying that equality is what is, as an alternative. Stiglitz is here saying no, that's actually not what he is saying. We realize, he says, that would weaken incentives. The question is, how seriously would incentives be weakened if we had a little bit less inequality? So he's being honest, in a sense, and saying, actually, what progressive economists, as they call themselves, like Stiglitz, are advocating for is not equality, but a little bit less inequality. So we, in this book and in the project and so on, would like to have tried to take, in a sense, this discourse at its words and try to explain exactly how that works and what it does, specifically how it governs our cities, our lives, and so on. The details are in the rest of the book. They involve, in this case, the section on architectural plans, mostly, as you've been seeing, a series of case studies that begins with New York by Gary in New York and refers to things like norms, and actually, I think rather importantly in this discussion, the construction of the household as an economic category, the unit by which things like inequality are measured, which I think, as both Jacob and Suzanne suggested, must be understood as a social construction in a variety of ways. Okay, so I think I'll leave it at that. And since this is a provisional report, I'll leave the conclusion open-ended, and perhaps then there's a few minutes for discussion. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this brief insight in this really fantastic book on the art of inequality. I wonder, became very clear from what you said that inequality is something designed and not a historical given or accident or nothing we should think of natural. Would it be possible, or would you think about the attempts of designing equality? Because, of course, the architectural history is full of those attempts, and I think the moment when architects actually invented for their profession actually housing as a topic, well, it's a rather recent phenomenon in a way, in large scale. equality was the main topic. And of course, one could argue, well, maybe this was a historical failure, architects maybe emphasizing their role a bit too much. Well, how would you relate inequality and equality in terms of all the aspects you mentioned, legal, design, etc.?
You guys want to say something? I can go with some of the examples, but go ahead if you want.
No, I think it's better to stick to the examples. No, the examples that we have in the book, which are in Reinhold's section.
I invited your question, so I'm going to answer it.
No, I think it's better to use the ones that you,
Well, I would like to point to the exhibition, which some people have not recognized as an exhibition in its version here, because it so seamlessly fits into this the surroundings. But our exhibition is on view in the blue sofas up on the gallery next to the coat check. So it is an exhibition.
And you'll hear certain voices speaking to you if you listen carefully.
But there's one video clip in particular I'd like to point you to on this question, and it relates to the discussion about diversity and sameness and inequality, which are all related somehow. And there's a short clip of Glenn Beck, who is a conservative, or was a conservative...
Is?
Yeah. Talk show. Oh, he came back. Okay. He's... He's basically ranting against an equalized society and says, if we're all going to be the same, we all need to have the same stuff, and we're going to end up living in a place that looks like this. It's Co-op City, and these are 33-floor towers that actually do look very Eastern European, but they were built in New York. And so the idea that equality would imply sameness and would not allow for diversity, and of course diversity, especially in a politically correct context, actually implies that we can accommodate a diversity of people, that we can't be homogenized. So I think that's part of the difficulty, how to balance in the public perception equality with the right to be different, let's say. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well said. I will just add so one of the examples, a kind of glaring example in a sense of architectural inequality, like the architecture of inequality, one could say, that we refer to in the book. I do this in my essay. Is the New York by Gehry building in Lower Manhattan. You know, Frank Gehry's tower, you've seen it, the plan was circulating a little while ago. So one of there was a time during the Occupy Wall Street protests, some of the protests went right by that building. And so if you, you know, that, above, and more than anything else, presents, you know, in one photograph, as it were, this, you know, raises this question: how could this be in a society, you know, that is so divided that it's necessary for people to raise their voices against this thing? One of the lesser known facts about that building, I mean, I explain here about how it's designed to make money. This is a very, very important thing about that building, and virtually all the architecture we are talking about here, is that it is capital. It's an investment. It's specifically designed to make money, including off of poor people. Not in the case of Gehry so much, but in some of the more low-cost housing. It actually is designed to make money off of some of the poorest people in New York City. So, you know, that's fact number one. So, when you ask the question, what is it, equality, it would have to somehow address that level of discussion, the political economic, as well as what it might look like, how it might work. And, of course, one of the more available critiques of the 20s and 30s efforts, you know, all over Europe and then subsequently in other parts of the world, has been that it has been, as it were, superstructural, that architecture has not been able to get underneath. We're not actually arguing that quite. But what we are, because architecture, the point is that there's not like some superstructural level and a base economic level in which the real stuff happens. But rather, what we're calling the art of inequality is the kind of constant interaction between these levels. And architecture is one of the mediating agents there. So here's just an example. There is an instance in that building that is, as it were, more equal, let's say. Very minimally more, but, you know, importantly. Which is to say that at the base of that building, in order for that building to get built, because there is still a thing called the state, even though the state has withdrawn, as you said, from much of these responsibilities, it was the developers had to negotiate with the city, and they had to provide a public school. So at the base of that building, there is a public school. If you look at that school, it is not designed, as it were, by Frank Gehry. It sort of is, but it's brick. It doesn't have any of the, you know, flashy architecture of the Gehry signature. And so it's in that gap. And of course, it's a school for people who live near Wall Street. It's still for the relatively wealthy. But it's a public school. It's very important. That's a significant difference. It's a public school, and something that implies something like equal access to education, right? Where architecture comes in here is not so much the brick, but in the difference. The key structural fact is the difference between the school and the metal-clad building, that is built over it and on it. And until we develop the critical tools and the creative tools, I'm not just talking about analysis, but the interventions, the capacity to intervene in that gap, in that moment, when rather than, let's say, the public school being the condition for which speculation is going to be possible, on which it's possible, but rather that gap becomes unthinkable. And architecture can help make that unthinkable, if you think about it. Then we're not going to be able to answer the question in any satisfactory way.
I'd like to open up the discussion, of course, to the audience. So if there are any questions, please go ahead. There's one over there.
In the kind of contemporary discussions of inequality where things like the middle class or like the 1% or whatever are the kind of the terms there. There's a certain tautological aspect to these, like where the middle class is kind of self-defined as the middle, and there's always going to be a mid-range of a spectrum. There'll always be a top 1% of any kind of number set, and then and it seems like it has this kind of a separation from a functional definition of the classes, like the middle class is not like the working class or the ruling class or the property owning class versus the renter class. And this seems really different than the kind of early modernist housing projects, which had to do with functionalism and this kind of rhetoric of function and like the functional city. And so workers' housing was designed for people who had a certain role in the value form, and the way that they the way they were housed had to do with the way that they made money. And so now that it seems like one of the kind of the miseries and the weirdnesses of the kind of the neoliberal hyper-financialized real estate cities, you always ask, where do these people get their money? Where's all this money coming from? And this is the mystery of neoliberalism is that the making of the money is separated from the form. And so in the the architecture of this, what's the kind of the current status of thinking about function, and how does that work with issues of production relative to reproduction in the city?
I can answer. I'll answer. So yeah, it's a great question, Alan. And it's I think maybe I would quickly revise by saying that actually these houses, these at every level, are functioning. The money is being made by the house itself. You're right, that this is a second order, it's like a displacement onto this presumably more abstract plane of financial speculation that capital is doing its work now. But that's why we kind of insisted that these are functional objects, these at every level. But the difference at this point is that they are in, they essentially function at different levels, and you're pointing out they function in the more classical level of as dwellings. That you're, you know, that's kind of the part one, and part two being that they function as investments. But they're a very specific function. In other words, the purpose is to make money, as I said, off of the whole spectrum up and down the class structure, class system. I'll just add one thing, though, and it kind of to bridge Nicholas's question with yours, that one thing we could ask, if indeed what we're dealing with is a way of governing our lives, a way our lives and the lives of others are being governed, then architects can ask, taking this into account, and if governing, as it were, is one of the principal functions of the household in the form of both the classical form of producing norms and standards and all kinds of stereotypes and so on, but also now by producing wealth, how might we be governed differently? How might we imagine, literally, a different government of housing? How might our lives be arranged differently, be governed differently through the houses in which we live? So that would address your question somewhat differently.
Yeah. Here, Teddy, another question.
Thinking about exactly that question, let's imagine that obviously inequality emerges out of the violent blow that neoliberalism has exerted not only in the city but in our social and economic resources. And in doing so, really emerges out of the polarization of public and private interests. So where is the public today? What forms of governance would enable us to approach more equitable forms of urbanization and therefore, by consequence, inclusive housing? At a moment when the social or social democratic welfare state model is absent, where do we imagine the possibilities of inclusive governance that can enable these new paradigms?
Thanks, Suzanne.
What can be done now?
Yeah, but go ahead.
I alluded to the invisibility of a lot of the policies that exist now. The state is very, very present in everything. I mean, the New York by Gary Tower had, I don't know how
Absolutely,
many
yeah.
billion of federal bonds to finance it, but they also, in their mission as the public sector, extracted enough fees from that deal to then pay for 3,000 units of low-income housing somewhere else in New York, right? So I don't know where that qualifies within public and private interest, but it's all mixed up. The market can't exist without the public subsidies. And neither can the low-income housing that's produced. And I was going to say something else. But anyway, this invisibility. So I think part of the task of this book that we set ourselves is just to actually address some of these relationships and make us aware. So if you knew how many tax the simple fact that all housing is subsidized, I think a lot of people aren't aware of this, especially the people who think of themselves as middle class, who have a home ownership and are allowed to deduct a lot of that their interest payment from their taxes. They don't perceive themselves as being aided by the government. They think that the government's just doing that for the poor, and then maybe they're becoming aware that the rich are also being aided. But that kind of just becoming aware of that and then acting as an active citizen in how you vote, and that's just one path. Yes. That's nothing to do with you being an architect and demanding a different tax structure. I mean, that's one thing. So again, what does it have to do with architecture? It's very difficult because in a way, nothing, but in a way, everything. Because as you say, the capital and the wealth has to be materialized in some way, and architects do that.
So. He's in charge.
We agree on those issues. I wasn't really talking about the conventional alliance between public and private that in the last years of neoliberal dominance has been more private than anything. The public has been camouflaged as enabling more the private interest. I was speaking more about the aspiration of a true public agenda, which hopefully not only has disappeared, but it seems not functional today. So maybe the condition that emerges is maybe ways of transcending that binary by enabling communities to be part of the conversation, by enabling other actors, social and civic, that can enable us to go beyond the typical public private partnerships that have gotten us nowhere really in this possibility.
I guess that's a
That's a very good last word for that first session. I think there will be.
Can we invite you all? Though we wanted to invite everybody to a party. Well, can we do that? I know it's just a little ad. This is available in the bookstore.
Bookstore downstairs. Also download online for free if you don't want to pay the €4 downstairs. And if you want the thing.
And on what Monday?
9:30.
Anybody who's anywhere in Berlin and wanting to have a drink at 9:30 in the evening, come over to Books People Places, a new wonderful bookstore in Schöneberg, where we're going to sort of launch this book in its at least into Europe. So
should all come.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Haushausen. Well, now. Move on with a very different angle, more visual angle, I guess, with Amy Siegel, whose work you hopefully have seen downstairs.